The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Daniel Coyle. Daniel is the New York Times bestselling author of The Talent Code, The Little Book of Talent, The Secret Race, and other books. Winner with Tyler Hamilton of the 2012 William Hill Sports Book of the Year Prize. He is a contributing editor for Outside Magazine and also works as a special advisor to the Cleveland Indians. His new book is called The Culture Code, The Secrets of Highly Successful Groups. Daniel Coyle, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here, Kelly. Thanks for having me.
One of the ideas that comes up in this podcast repeatedly is debunking the myth that creative individuals and groups are somehow imbued with magic that makes them special in some way. And you dispense with this idea in the introduction to The Culture Code when you write, quote, "While successful culture can look and feel like magic, the truth is that it's not. Culture is a set of living relationships working towards a shared goal. It's not something you are, it's something you do."
Exactly right. And the thing that really, I spent the last 5 years visiting really successful cultures and some spectacularly unsuccessful ones. And looking at the patterns that they share. And, you know, we have this idea of culture as this kind of fuzzy aura that certain groups have or don't. Mm-hmm. But when you look beneath that aura, what you see is this really hard grammar, like these signals that get sent that are about, are we safe? Do we share risk? Do we share accurate information? And where are we going? So it's really sort of primal. And the whole idea of the book is if you get good at sending these signals, you can get good at building culture. There's not some magical aura that's going to sort of descend on you from on high, but it happens in interactions. And if you learn how to tune in moments and deliver the right signal, it gets a lot better.
So we do a lot of work with the academic community, and one of the things that this is what we fight about with them, because they're like, well, there's not a lot of data that says that teams are more creative than individuals, but the fact is they haven't studied in any significant way these teams that perhaps stay together for a long period of time, because it's kind of hard to study, whereas it's easier to bring in individuals. What you do is go to the source. I mean, whether it's, IDEO or UCB or, you have military stuff, right? So I think you had to go suss this out, because it's a lot of places where the academics just don't find themselves.
That's exactly right. And the cool news is that beyond that, there's this new science called sociometrics, where they put little sort of transmitters on people, and it captures their tone of voice, it captures their location in space, it captures how often they interact, and you get this x-ray of what successful group interaction looks like. And the news on that is all successful creative groups have kind of the same fingerprint. They have the same x-ray, which is tons of face-to-face collisions. They're not like working in remote groups. They're in a room together, physically in space together. There's high-energy interactions, and everybody talks to everybody. You get that same sort of pattern. You can see it from space. And it's actually the same feeling we have when we walk into a room with it's a solid culture, a successful group. You walk into a restaurant, your favorite restaurant, you walk into a great school, or you walk into the house where there's a sort of a great family. Those interactions have got this tempo and this snap and this kind of pattern that you see, and we can feel it as human beings. And what this science is doing is actually taking that outside the realm of gut feel and saying, no, this is actually what it looks like. It's not magic, but if we get the right people in the room, we can make it happen.
You write about Will Phelps, who studies organizational behavior at the University of South Wales in Australia, and he conducted a workplace study that he called the Bad Apple Experiment. I love this. Tell us what happened in the Bad Apple Experiment.
Really, really a devilishly clever experiment. So he got these groups together, groups of four, to do this kind of difficult problem together, and then he put in a confederate, an actor. And this actor was really good. Actually, he had been in the Rocky Horror Picture Show, I think, was one of his credits. But he played one of four parts. He either played kind of an aggressive jerk, like he would make aggressive comments kind of subtly, or he would be kind of depressed and apathetic, or he would be sort of actively negative. And So in playing each of those roles, Will Phelps, it was like injecting a virus into the body and seeing how the body responds. And how it responds was fascinating because group performance went down 30 to 40% in each of those groups. Just instantly, just being in the presence of a bad apple diminishes everyone because we're getting a strong signal that, hey, this isn't safe. This isn't going to work out. This is this group isn't going anywhere. And so our brains sort of are built to switch over to sort of bailing and getting out of this. So in order to create that kind of group, you really need to do what I saw good groups do, which was really be kind of ruthless about bad apples.
I love, too, that he met his match, right? There was like one group where this didn't happen, and that was like someone who was so relentlessly positive and engaging that he couldn't take over the room.
It was unbelievable. There was a kid in the experiment who was a subject in the experiment who actually was the son of a diplomat, and he had extraordinary social skills. So whenever the bad apple would make a comment, this guy would find a way to engage him. Like he would take in the comment and really hear it and sort of move discussion, and always, never in a dismissive way, but always sort of connecting with him. And pretty soon the bad apple started to get frustrated. Like he started to become good and drove him kind of crazy. But it was a beautiful example of how this is not like, you know, again, it doesn't descend on high. It's about this guy knew how to deliver the right interaction at the right moment to create the connection.
So there's a great Second City example of that. We had an actor in Detroit who was tremendously talented, and we really wanted to move him down to Chicago. And that gets tricky when we move people like from our Toronto stage or whatever, because there's just like, again, there's cultural differences and, you know, this particular person, you could not behave poorly in a room. And this person is Keegan-Michael Key, who has gone on to incredible success. But he was so relentlessly loud and positive that it's like you just could, like it dissipated. No matter how negative you were, it just couldn't live in that room. And I've seen that true of people like Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, who are both like that. It's just their strength is you know, too great to allow negativity to sort of fester.
That's fantastic. And there's something very primal about it, isn't there? Like, you know, we often sort of put a lot of stock in what people say, but there's so much more communication that goes on beyond words.
Yeah, I'm going to quote you from the book because it's just great, where you say, quote, words are noise. Group performance depends on behavior that communicates with one powerful overarching idea. We are safe and connected. I want to talk to you about belonging cues. I found this a very powerful section. And you talk about Google's Larry Page pinning a note to the wall in Google's kitchen that read, "These ads suck." And one of his employees, Jeff Dean, saw the note. And I think this is a great story of an individual in a situation that sets up this idea around belonging cues. Who is Jeff Dean and what did he do?
Jeff Dean, the backstory is that Google was involved. This is back in 2002. So they were involved in this big competition to see who could figure out this, how to put ads on the internet. And it was a potentially multi-billion dollar market. And they were way behind in the race. There were other companies that had way more money, way more expertise. But Google had this remarkable sort of sense of connection. And we would call it just that magic culture. And where does that come from is sort of the question. And it turns out that it all kind of happened on one day. Larry Page, who's the CEO, had been looking at the recent results of the project, and he said, "This stuff sucks." And he just put it on the wall, boom, and it was a big marker. And a guy was walking by, his name was Jeff Dean, who didn't even work in this area. He wasn't even on this project. Mm-hmm. But Google is the kind of place where if there's something to be done, you do it. They would play roller hockey at lunch, and you could bash into the founders. You could cross domains and grab a problem and fix it. You were sort of always arguing and always working toward these common goals. And Jeff Dean spotted it, and he just kind of got curious. And without telling anybody, he spent that night, the next day, and the next day working on this problem. He put everything else aside to work on this problem. Mm-hmm. And then he solved it, and it ended up being this giant step in Google dominating this space. It ends up being this sort of historic billion-dollar day. But it all happens in this moment where Jeff Dean feels safe and connected enough to say, well, that's not really my problem, but I'm really curious about it. These are the guys that whack me with hockey sticks at lunch. We're tribally connected, and our zone is sort of flooded with these belonging cues enough to where I feel safe enough to take this risk. In that moment, is at the core of every good culture where you have this, that's what safety's for. You know, we sometimes think safety as being just this atmospheric feeling like, oh, we just want to feel safe. That's really not what it's for. It's functional.
Yeah.
Like if your group is going to be more than the sum of its parts, everybody's got to feel free to take on stuff like that and to make to take a risk. The point of safety is taking a risk, and so that's why Google ended up winning, not because they were necessarily smarter or more organized, but because they created an environment where a guy walking by a cafeteria could like see something and pick it up and solve it.
And I think you bring up such a good point, which is, you know, psychological safety doesn't happen in an initial training center session that never gets talked about again. There was a great phrase someone said that we've been, you know, running from lions a lot more longer than we've been running for the bus. The way the brain is wired, you have to signal this stuff over and over again. And I think your story of that Wipro call center in Bangalore, India, is a great example of how this doesn't work and how it can work.
That's exactly right. Now, there was this great story because there was this call center. Call centers are boring places to work, right?
Yeah.
Hard job. And so every year, about half the people would leave, and they were struggling with that. And they tried to make their place more attractive and give perks, but still, everybody would leave, half the employees. So they did this crazy experiment where they took a new class. They divided it into two. Half of them got the ordinary orientation. The others got this extra hour where all they did was sort of ask them questions. And they said, hey, like simple questions, like, what happens on your best day? And tell me, if we were on a desert island, like, what would you bring to the survival process? Really simple questions. Instead of learning about the company, they really made a connection. And then they tracked those people to say, hey, are these people going to stick around any longer than the usual employee? And it turns out the retention shot up 270%. They hung around 270% more often than the other employees. And the reason, it wasn't magic, it was that they got this simple, really clear signal: we are connected. We share a future with you. We're interested in you. And sending that signal at the right time, there's, you know, belonging, and that sense of safety doesn't happen. It doesn't just magically occur. It happens when you have these interactions where you're sending a clear cue and you're showing interest and you're showing that you share a future.
All right. We're going to talk about pop. So Steve Kerr, when he played here on the Bulls, used to come to Second City all the time and has now made it.
No way.
Yeah. And he's made it a tradition. So like he just brought Steph the other night when Golden State came here and beat the hell out of the Bulls. And it was great. And he's just such a nice man. And recently I saw it was on Twitter, the video that was sort of framed of like, it's always great when someone believes in you. And all it was picked up audio of Steve Kerr telling Steph Curry how much he admired him and loved what he did. And one of the sections is where he goes, you know, my mentor is Pop, and Pop always said, like, in the difficult times, that's when you need each other kind of thing. And you have a whole section on Greg Popovich, the coach of the San Antonio Spurs. I'd love you to talk about what makes him so sort of fiercely special in this arena.
It's so funny that you noticed that clip. That is the most beautiful. I hope that I saw it had like 1.5 million views. It really is an incredible example. That current Curry clip is amazing. See their relationship up close.
Actually. Oh yeah, I mean it brought like it's a very emotional. Like my wife teared up looking at it, and she doesn't even know who these people are.
Right, it's unbelievable, and that is what Pop does. Like if anybody wants to know what Pop does, that's what he does. But it's actually two things that he does. You know, if you're from a distance, for those of you who don't know Greg Popovich, he's the most hard-ass coach in the NBA. Like, he's the most old-school guy. His face is red the most often, yelling at his team. He called a timeout the other night, 14 seconds into the game, because he was ticked off at how his team was playing. Uh-huh. 14 seconds. So he's an Air Force Academy guy. So what you see from a distance is that. You see him pushing his guys, telling them these hard truths. What you don't see is those Steve Kerr moments. What you don't see is when he puts his hand on their shoulder and says, hey, how was dinner last night? The dinner that I arranged for you and the dinner that I ordered the wine for. And they eat together as often as probably more often than most families do, the Spurs do. He is so tuned in to sending signals of relationship and connection to his players. And the day I visited was an incredible example of that, because they had lost the night before, so they go in to watch game film. And you sort of think, oh, this is going to be kind of a tough session. He's going to be tough on these guys. And the film starts, and it's actually a CNN documentary on the Civil Rights Act. And they watch that together. And he's like, you guys are wealthy black men. What would you have done in that situation? And he starts kind of holding this seminar, but very, very straightforward, very challenging thing. This is a big thing. Let's talk about this. And he does that kind of stuff all the time. So that level of respect, care, love, whatever you want to call it, is what is combined with the truth that he's given them. He's given them hard truths, high candor. Like he tells them when they're being lazy, when they're doing what he calls fake hustle. But he also loves them. So you get this great combination of you're in this group, we have these standards, here we do it this way, I'm going to care for you, and we're going to work harder together than any team ever has. And there's a reason that they're the winningest franchise in sports for the last 20 years.
This guy is so woke. I mean, like the fact that he, again, an older white man who has educated himself about the plight of black people in this country and is not afraid to talk about it with these men, right? And like and it's what a testament to understanding that they have a whole different experience in life and knowledge area given who they are and what the color of their skin is, which where you feel like I don't know, like no one else is doing that. It's really brave.
It's really brave. And the players respond in kind. They really do. The other day they came through Cleveland where we live part of the year. And I met with one of the assistant coaches, and I said, what did you do last night? He goes, yeah, it was kind of crazy. Spike Lee came and talked to the team. Like, really? You know, just sort of stuff like that, where it's, you know, it's about, I think a lot of times in work, we end up sort of defining it down. Right. And I think what you see in great cultures is that they're connecting, they're defining it up. They're saying, this is life. Let's talk about some stuff. Let's do some stuff together. Let's bring our whole person to this conversation, not just sort of, you know, make us smaller than we are. Let's make us bigger than we are.
And you mentioned food. So this is a thing. So I started Second City in 1988. I was a dishwasher. It was my first gig out of college. And this is still when it was like the founders of Second City were around. And it was like, you know, you could smoke in the theater and your feet stuck to the ground because of the beer from the night before. Whole different like world that we lived in. It was decidedly not woke. Let's actually say that.
Right.
However, and the pay was shitty. But people loved it. And one of the things that happened like all the time was we ate together. So anyone's birthday on staff, and I don't care if you were the dishwasher or in the main stage cast, pizza was ordered and bad champagne was served. And there was tap beer. And then on Friday, Joyce Sloan, who's the producer, I created a thing called the Kelly Leonard Dinner Club. I would get a different ethnic food every Friday for us to eat that she'd just take money out of the you know, till and give to me. I'm apologizing right now to the owner of Second City because we were technically stealing money from the company. But what I didn't understand was like she, all sorts of sins and ills that were going on in that sort of environment didn't matter, in part because there was such a communal feel of like we are together, we're breaking bread together. And Pop does this, and Joe Madden does this. You have a great story about that. There really is power, and you talk about Pixar, where they say, you know, food really is a core part of their business. What was your research to find out what was at play with that stuff?
You know, I just kept seeing that pattern over and over and over again. What do we as humans do? You know, there's certain activities that sort of connect very, very, very deeply. And circling up and eating together is one of them. And so good cultures end up maximizing that interaction, maximizing it. You know, you referenced Pixar. You know, they for a while, they had a food service come in. Then they realized people were leaving because the food was kind of average. And they said, wait a minute. This is really part of our business. We need to create an environment where people will gather up enthusiastically and want to be here. And so they took over the food service themselves. And it's really primal. It's really simple. But those moments, for instance, on the Spurs, after the coaches eat together before every game. Mm-hmm. And the joke is it helps to be bulimic because Pop sometimes goes to two restaurants. He loves to eat. And so they end up at the end of the year getting a leather-bound album with every menu of the place they ate and the wines they drank. And it's a small thing. Like, all this stuff is small stuff, right? It's all small stuff.
Yep.
But it's powerful stuff. And so when you look back at the year and you remember that time together, like you're remembering the time at Second City, it's not magic. It's interaction.
Yeah. All right. I think most people who have a passing knowledge of the Navy SEALs and the world of improvisation might be taken aback at how you link those two worlds in this book. I mean, I get it. Because I've lived in this stuff forever, but I think you need to explain how in the hell those two things are connected.
Yep, you bet. Well, let's start with some more badass ones, which of course would be improv. in improvisation, there's this. I really got inside the Upright Citizens Brigade and learned about the Herald, which they're obsessed with.
Yep,
of course, a sort of game that is the hardest one. There's a bunch of threads. I could explain it, but it would be just confusing if I tried to explain it. There's a bunch of threads. There's a bunch of people. It's very involved, and it creates this atmosphere of total vulnerability. The rules of the Herald are really clear. You can't ever make yourself a center. You can't ever make a joke. You have to constantly support everyone. So it can be like this excruciating experience. And so I saw how that built great culture, great connection, great trust, great cohesion, great cooperation by being completely vulnerable together. They learn to support each other and learn to see and react to certain comic situations in a very fluid, fast way. That's why those classes are so effective at growing good comedians.
Yep. Yeah.
And then I go to hang out with the lesser of the badass groups, the Navy SEALs, and what are they doing? They're holding a log, and it's like a telephone pole. And you know, Navy SEALs are pretty sophisticated technologically, right? They've got night vision. They've got the best guns in the world. They've got all this stuff. They train an unusual amount of time with a log. Like, there are very few times where you need to have a big log in combat. Do we need to get this log through this wall? It doesn't happen. So why are they doing that? And I dug into that story, and this log drill started a long time ago. But the reason they do it is it creates these unbelievable moments of vulnerability where you have to tune in to how the person next to you, you're just holding it above your head, doing calisthenics with it. You're trying to sort of control this big thing altogether. But in order to do that, you have to be like exquisitely tuned in to the people around you. And so it creates these moments of awareness exactly like the Herald does.
Yep.
It's the sort of physical version of the Herald. And so it really, all of it adds up to underline this really simple truth about trust that I don't think we understand very well. It's the trust is built through shared vulnerability.
Yep.
It's through a vulnerability loop. Trust doesn't happen just to happen. It doesn't happen when you trust a little, trust more, trust more, trust more. Trust happens when two people like hold hands and jump somewhere together, risky. And that's what the SEALs, you know, the SEALs have the best teamwork. Why is that? Because they are constantly creating vulnerability loops. These improv comedians that are coming out of places like Second City and UCB are so brilliant. Why is that? Because they're constantly creating these situations of mutual vulnerability where they have to support each other. So it's not, again, it's that idea that culture is built in these sort of group habits, almost like calisthenics. You know, if you want your body to get strong, you know that you have to experience pain. Like, we take that, we say, well, that pain will bring us gain. Well, groups are wired the same way. You have to experience that pain of vulnerability, like, I'm really hanging it out there with other people. And then you experience that cooperative gain, that fiber of trust and cooperation gets built.
So I'm going to admit that I was cribbing from your work last night. I did give you credit. So literally last evening, for a small group of people, a sort of a curated group, my wife, who's an improv teacher and comedy professor, myself and our friend Neil, who used to run the IDEO office here in Chicago, gave a workshop about design thinking and improvisation. And the opening thing we did with everyone, we're like, oh, everyone get up. So this is a thing that we think these two worlds share, which is in design thinking, we talk about openness and inspiration, and in improvisation, we talk about people being others focused. So first, we're going to have you do this improv exercise. So we had them do a spacewalk where they sort of walked around, and then Anne had them adjust things like now acknowledge a person, now look them in the eye, now look at them in the eye for an uncomfortable period of time, and they're starting to increase their sort of like they're laughing and they're and then she stops them and they get in pairs, and then Neil jumps in and says, everyone grab a pencil and a piece of paper. You have 1 minute to draw each other, go. And as we deconstructed what each of us were doing, we're like, we're kind of doing the same thing, but through these different channels. In design thinking, you're kind of thinking in the world of post-its and pencils and building, and I want to get you in that mindset, but I need you to be in the place where you're looking at someone else and trying to lose the judgment that happens when you sort of look at someone and draw someone. And we're kind of saying, you know, from our point of view, we need you to be in this others-focused place where we need you to acknowledge and get out of your self-brain and into the other brain, and immediately it warmed the room. And they all mentioned this. They're like, oh, God, once we did that, we were engaged in a whole different kind of way.
That is so cool. That is so cool. Well, it's great to be able to create that situation over and over again. And imagine if you did that with that group every day for 6 months.
That's the key.
It's amazing to think what that can be when it's transformed from like this cool moment into a habit.
Yeah, yeah. And then so another sort of point you've got, which goes back to the small thing, was the MIT professor Thomas Allen, who said, quote, "The most successful projects were those driven by sets of individuals who formed what Allen called clusters of communication." Now, that sounds complicated, but in the study you've got, it's not complicated as to who's collaborating well together, because it's about nearness.
Exactly right. He did this huge study of what projects succeed. And the answer was ones where people are sitting close to each other. Like, face-to-face interaction works on us like a drug. And it increases our energy. It increases our idea flow. There's these studies with these sociometrics I mentioned earlier where they'll take a remote group and a group that's together. And the group that's together will, like, talk about the problems about four times more often. They just come up. They just bubble up. And it seems kind of magical until you really think about it. Well, how did we evolve? You know, how did our brains evolve? Yeah. And our brains evolved by interpreting closeness as a sign of safety, connection. You're in my tribe. So we relax, we start to get into, I guess you could call it group brain, mm-hmm. and the creativity and the connection and the creative cluster that happens because we're behaving in a way that's aligned with the way our wires of our brain are built.
Nearness. I mean, the fact that your desks are close to each other. It's funny that I struggle with the open office situation because I know that some people are introverts and have difficulty. But what I realized is that you need both, right? You need that space where you can collide, and you need space to reflect. I'm sitting here in the WGN studios in the Tribune Tower, and we're moving. This whole group is going to move to a new building, and I was talking to the folks about how that's going to be set up, and they really thought about that. We want to create a hub where people can collide, but have spaces they can go and do their reflection.
That's really smart.
Okay, so one of the stories inside this book is about the Tylenol scare. In a previous incarnation of my work at Second City, we had to do a tour. It was a tour of Second City and Old Town, the sort of place where our neighborhood. And I don't know if you know this, but the Walgreens across from Second City was one of the Walgreens where they discovered the
tainted. No way. Yep. I heard shock at that Walgreens. Holy mackerel.
Yeah. So why is the Tylenol scare inside this book?
Well, you know, you get to the core thing that all groups really have is a sense of purpose, a sense of story, like what to do when there's a problem, what you do. Good groups react like a school of fish moving through a coral reef, moving through problems. Like they know which way to go and they stay together. So the greatest example of a group doing that was Johnson & Johnson, the parent company of Tylenol. Because when the Tylenol crisis happened, it looked like it was absolutely the end. Their product had been used as a murder weapon. Like, who's going to buy Tylenol ever? But for the few years prior to actually what happened was the brand responded. The people of that company responded with incredible cohesion. They were very transparent around it. They invented new packaging. All the new packaging that we use now started then. They didn't have that. And they were very transparent with the public. They were great with the lawyers. They sort of swung into action, almost like that school of fish solving this problem together. And as a result, we have Tylenol around today. But the reason that happened was that for the 4 years before that, their CEO, this guy named James Burke, would create conversation around the question, what are we about? Hmm. What are we about? What are we about? And he forced everyone to confront, what are we about? Making profits? Are we about taking care of doctors? Are we about taking care of patients? And as a result of this, they ended up with this very clear credo, they called it, sort of the Moses Ten Commandments sort of thing. But it was really, really clear. Our first priority is to take care of the users of our product. That's our first priority. And so creating this intense, engaged conversation for 4 years before this happened, when it did happen, it was totally confusing and difficult, but they had a true north that they could point to. Everybody understood what they were about. Everybody understood that patients and users came first. And so whenever it came time to make a decision about, well, should we pull this $100 million of product off the shelves, which hasn't really been affected, should we pull it? The answer was, yeah, we should. And they did. They pulled $100 million worth of product off the shelves. That's what gave them that cohesion. And it makes sense from kind of a functional point of view. Like, that's their story. Like, that's their highest priority. And any group, whether it's the Navy SEALs, whether it's Pixar, has got something like that. And so for all of us in groups, it's like, that's a challenge, you know, like, what's your North Star? What comes first? And it's hard to have that conversation. It forces you to make tough choices. But man, when there's a crisis, it pays off.
Well, one of the scholars who's talked and studied about improvisation is Carl Weick out of the University of Michigan, and he was the first one to sort of talk about the need for improvisational behavior in moments of crisis. They actually did a study of airline carriers and where you're landing a plane in the sea, and the fact that what they needed to train people was the ability to spot potential errors or mistakes in split seconds and change and adapt and listen to each other, which are all improvisational skills. And I think most people would be like, no, if crisis, I don't want anyone improvising. It's like, no, that's exactly when you want the tool set of an improviser, because things change so quickly.
I love that. Oh my God.
So I'm going to ask you in a second for a yes and story, which we ask for every guest. But before you do that, why does picking up trash make you a good leader?
It's funny. That's a pattern that I saw over and over and over again in coaching situations and CEO situations. Why are all these guys picking up trash? Like the CEO, Tony Hsieh's a billionaire. Why is he picking up trash?
Uh-huh.
But they all did it because it sends this incredible signal that it sends, actually, like all good gestures, it sends this whole layer cake of signals. It sends a signal, I'm not above you. It sends a signal, we care about this environment. And it sends a signal, we care about each other. So it's this very small behavior that ends up looming really large.
Yeah, I think that's so cool. We had a problem in our area where there's an open kitchen and people were leaving dirty dishes. We tried putting up notes. We tried doing that. And then I just was like, fuck it. I'm going to do the dishes. And so I just started doing it. And people would walk by. I'm like, what? Why is Kelly? This is embarrassing. Why is Kelly doing the dishes? And then, then other people started doing it. And suddenly that the behavior was done. It was like, nope, we're pretty really good cool. Right now.
Yeah, right. Signals. It's about signals. You send a really, really clear signal. And
yep.
People respond.
I love it. All right. So I want you to tell us a yes and story. So in our world, you're making something out of nothing with others. The way that you do that poorly is by saying no. You do it poorly by saying yes, but. The only way you can do it is by saying yes and. Do you have a yes and moment that you can share with us?
I think I do. As a journalist, I always have opportunities to write about stuff and it was back in 2003, and somebody said, oh, there's an opportunity to write a book about cycling, like a book about the Tour de France. Tough, interesting topic. I was really, really curious to go there and write about it. And then I was sort of thinking, wow, but I have my family. I have four young kids. One was just 1.5 years old. What do we do? And we decided, let's yes and it. Let's do it and let's bring the family.
Huh.
And we ended up spending about 15 months living in Spain, and it remains sort of one of the peak experiences of life to sort of throw everybody in that, have everybody experience together. Did I do as good of a job as I might have if I had just isolated myself and done it? I don't know. But it added so much to the experience that I think the whole thing ended up being a big victory.
That's awesome. The power of travel, even with the young kids, is something I found with my guys that they've never forgot. Even though some of those trips they were, two or three, there's something in like they were in Italy, or they were in Vienna or whatever.
Yep.
That's imprinted upon them. That's a great yes answer.
So cool. Yes, I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Daniel Coyle, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Kelly. Awesome. Love your work, too, by the way. I got to say that there are Navy SEALs I know who read and love your book.
Oh, that's great. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Down, working in a coal mine. Oh, about to slip down, working in a coal mine. Walking in a cold